All right, tonight we turn to the book of Ezra. Right. We left off last week with the ending of 2 Chronicles. We began our class with 2 Chronicles, the last chapter, and then we ended the 2 Chronicles, the last chapter. And what we dealt with last week was the captivity and all the things that surrounded it and happened within that captivity. Now, one of the things that we learned last week as we ended up is this. Excuse me, let me get this up here a little bit better. Is that about right there? Is what?
It's kind of leaning. There we go.
Yeah, okay. All right. One of the things that we learned last week was that they went into captivity, and there was a man by the name of Cyrus, who was the king that was stirred up by the Lord, and just all of a sudden, he determined that the Jews could leave and go back and restore the nation of Israel. Now, we learned that Isaiah, in Isaiah chapters 44 and 45, had prophesied that this man, by the name of Cyrus, actually called him by name. Now, he called him by name 200 years before he was ever born, and said Cyrus would be his servant and release them. So what a fantastic, fabulous thing that we see there in God speaking through Isaiah. So now then, tonight, we're going to turn to Cyrus, and we're going to see that he did turn the Jews loose. All right? We begin with the book of Ezra then, in chapter 1 and in verse 1. It says, "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it in writing, saying..." Now, keep in mind, this is the writing of a heathen king. Absolutely fantastic of what he is getting ready to say. And Isaiah said that a heathen king would say this 200 years before he was ever born. So now look what this heathen king, the proclamation that he made here, said, "Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath Jehovah the God of heaven given me. And he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whosoever there is among you of all his people, his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of Jehovah, the God of Israel, he is God, which is in Jerusalem." Heathen king has taken Jehovah God as the King of Kings. Now, can you tell me any other king that had been taught this? He was wrestling with it. He was trying to figure out, is Jehovah the great God that they say he is? Did that God known as Jehovah, did he give me all this power? Or did I do it by myself? He's wrestling with that problem.
Nebuchadnezzar,
that's right. Daniel had been telling him, "Buddy, don't you think you did this on your own? God gave you this. The only reason you did this is because God gave it to you." And then he told him, "If you don't believe it, you're going to end up wishing you had it. That is, you're going to go out and be eating that grass that we didn't talk about until seven times pass over you." And Nebuchadnezzar learned his lesson. And Cyrus now, down here, has again learned that lesson. So I merely bring it up, Nebuchadnezzar and so forth, that heathen kings have come to the conclusion that Jehovah is God. Well, Cyrus is one of them, and Cyrus says, "Now I'm going to turn all the Jews loose to go back." All right, starting now in verse 5, we see that God now stirs up the Jews. He stirs them up and gets them ready and willing to go back and do this job. It said, "Then rose up the heads of the fathers of the house of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, even all whose spirit God stirred up to go to build the house of Jehovah, which is in Jerusalem." Now, what is their job? This is going to be a big point we're going to be making tonight. Now, they are going to go back. What is their job specifically? To build the house of Jehovah, to build the temple, to rebuild the temple. Now, that is very important for us to remember in this class, and again in class next week, that they are going back to rebuild that house. Now, they're not going back to rebuild Jerusalem. Now, don't let me lead you astray. They are. They're going to end up rebuilding Jerusalem. But why are these people going back? That's the point I want to make. See, these people are going back for the purpose of rebuilding the temple that is in Jerusalem. There are some empty seats right up here. Just feel free to come right on up if you'd like. All right, they're going back to build that house of God. Now, as they go back to build the house of God, in the next few verses there, you find that they went back and they took a whole lot of things with them there. As they go back out, going back down to there to that restoration, it begins now in verse 7. So Cyrus the king brought forth the vessels of the house of Jehovah, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought forth out of Jerusalem and had put in the house of his gods. So when Nebuchadnezzar had conquered Jerusalem back there 70 years ago, he had conquered and taken the silver and the gold out of the temple. He had brought it up and put it in his own God's house. Now then, 70 years later, Cyrus says, you go in to our God, you go into the heathen God's house, and you get all of the vessels and take it back with you, because you're going to go back to restore the house of God. All right, what we find is, then, in chapter 1, 5 through 11, we're going to find that there is a total of 5,400 vessels that went in and 5,400 that came out in there. They, all of the vessels that were taken in, they brought back with them. In addition to that, we see that they brought back 49,897 Jews, came back, 736 horses, 245 mules, 435 camels, 6,720 asses, and 61,000 derricks of gold. I don't know how much a derrick is, so don't ask me. But it would be a huge amount of gold, and 5,000 pounds of silver, and 100 priest garments. Now, where did I get all that wisdom to know just exactly how much they brought back? Right. You go ahead and you read it, and it's all stated in there that these are the sum totals of what was brought back. Now, we're going to go through rather rapidly, and we're not going to stop and go into detail on a lot of things there. That's the reason I made these charts, for us to see some of the details clearly. So now then, they are coming back. All right, now as we get down in chapter 2, it said, now these are the children of the province that went up out of captivity, and of those that had been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So now some people, keep this in mind, some people who had gone into captivity some 70 years ago are now coming out of captivity at this time, plus a whole lot more people who had been born in captivity. Now, I want you to notice in verse 2 here, where it says, who came with Zerubbabel. Now, that fella is going to become an important man. This man by the name of Zerubbabel. Alright, now, what does Zerubbabel do? Zerubbabel is the man in charge of this exodus that's going back to do what?
To rebuild the temple.
See? All right, so he now is going to be the supervisor, the one in charge of going back to rebuild that temple. Now, as you go on down, you can see in chapter 3 and verse 2. Now, chapter 2 is just telling about these tribes and these tribes and these tribes, this and this and this, and telling the individuals that came back. So now then, go to chapter 3. And as you get there in verse 8, or verse 2, we have Zerubbabel there. But look in verse 1. When the seventh month was come, the children of Israel were in the cities. The people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. Now they were really united. And this becomes an important point, because without that unity, they will not be able to do their job. But with that unity, they will be able to accomplish it. So they were gathered together as one man. And then stood up Jeshua. Now that is not the Joshua that has lived hundreds of years before. But this is a priest now. He's going to be the priest at this time, Jeshua. And look at the other fellow, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, and they built this and they did that. Now in verse 4, and they kept the feast of the tabernacles as it is written, verse 6, from the first day of the seventh month began they to offer burnt offerings unto Jehovah, but the foundation of the temple of Jehovah was not yet laid. Now what were they going back to do? They were going back to rebuild that temple. All right, now when they went back and they did keep the feast here of tabernacles. They are starting to restore the Old Testament religion. See, this is what they're doing. They are to keep the feast, and so they're doing it. But at this time, they hadn't yet started that foundation because it's going to be a big job. Now in verse 8, now in the second year of their coming, so it took 2 years to get everything ready and get the ball rolling to rebuild this temple. In the second year of their coming into the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, began Zerubbabel. Now there he is. All right. Now he goes ahead talking about those other fellows, but I want you to skip down at the end of the verse. And there it says, to have the oversight of the work of the house of Jehovah. Now that is talking to about Zerubbabel. See, back up there. It refers back up to him. Zerubbabel has the oversight of the work of rebuilding that. In verse 10, and when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of Jehovah, so now they get busy building, and they do lay the foundation then at that time, and an interesting thing happens. Once they laid that foundation, skip to verse 12, but many of the priests and the Levites and the heads of the father's house, the old men that had seen the first house when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice, and many shouted aloud with joy. All right, now let's think about that for just a moment here. That back here, way back before the captivity, they had a temple. Who had built the temple? Solomon had built the temple. How grand and great was it? Oh my, as you go back and read about all the silver and gold and the grandeur, it just absolutely boggled the mind. And since I'm such a great artist, I'll have to do it this way. I can't draw anything great and so forth, but back here we have Solomon's temple. In other words, his temple is back here, and it is just filled full of all of this massive gold and silver. All right, as they go down through time, they go into captivity. Then they come out of captivity, and now they go out and they lay the groundwork, the foundation, to rebuild the temple. And this time, the foundation looks like that. And it really was despondent to the people that had known this. They began to cry when they saw this back over here. They began to cry and say, oh, this is just a terrible thing. Now that's what the old people did who had lived back here and seen this temple in all its glory. But the new people, all of the young people over here, they began to yell with glee because they had not seen that temple, and this over here is the beginning of a new temple. It's a joyous time in their life. They're going to get their temple back. Now one might say, well, they're really not restoring that temple in that way. But they are. Let's go back now and tell me what was the necessary ingredients that Solomon was to build. What was the minimum? What was it that God said he wanted? You find it in the tabernacle. Remember it started out in the tabernacle? And you had those two rooms. Alright, the holy place and most holy place. And they were just a very small building that is in there. And so it was divided into the holy and most holy place. And then Solomon built this. This was in the very center. This is where God met. This is where God said, I want you to build. This is where God said, I will meet you in the most holy place. Then Solomon went ahead and he expanded and he built all of these other things around there in all of its grandeur. But right here is the divine part. Now, when they came back, see, when Nebuchadnezzar took it, he took everything. But then when they come back, these poor people coming out of captivity, are they going to try to restore a multi-million-dollar temple? Or are they going to do what is necessary? So they come back, and they then build it according to God's specifications, which would be the very center of this year. So this is restored. it is the part that God said that he wanted, see? So it is a restoration. But you can see why the old people said, oh my, what a glory we had. And now then, we've got this little thing over here. But the young people yell with glee in here. I make a point whenever I'm preaching about young people and so forth that you're told, young people are told that they're wrong, and many times, and most of the time when they get in an argument with an adult, well, they do end up wrong. I mean, it's just that simple, you know, that the adult has had many, many years of life and should be right more often. But this is one time when the old people were wrong. They were despondent because we can't have it like we used to have it, and the young were joyous because we've got a start, and we've started out doing what God wants us to do. And so the crying and the yelling was of such a nature, in verse 13 it said you couldn't tell who was crying and who was yelling. The whole thing came into this. Roy?
Well, that hill wasn't an insignificant building, because even the disciples, when they were coming out with Jesus, and they said, look how tremendous this building is. And that was what he said.
Okay, this is a good point. Now let me say on this. That what this building is over here is, anybody remember the dimensions of what it would be over here? It was 10 cubits wide, and this back room was 10 cubits and the other was 20. So it would be 30 cubits long. Now I've drawn it in a square up here. But it would be 30 cubits. How long is a cubit? About 18 inches. So it would be 45 feet long and 15 feet wide, which would be a relatively small building. But then the point is made, over here, then they came back, they rebuilt it. But then when the disciples of Jesus looked at it, they talked about it and said, what a magnificent, awesome building. And it was back in this day. But what happened is, Herod came along, and Herod started building, and he started building again, and he built around this thing, until, again, it was an awesome building. Anybody remember how many years Herod built this thing? And it's still in the building? 4 to 6 years. Now, you've been building it. That's when Jesus said, you destroy this temple and I'll raise it in 3 days. And they thought he's talking about this. They said, we've been working on that for 4 to 6 years. Do you think you're going to do it in 3 days? You see? So it was an awesome building. But right here is the one that they had, which would be the bare necessity. All right. Now they laid the foundation then. Now in verse 4, the people around Jerusalem saw what they were doing. So they sent a message up and said, let us help you. We want to help you. Down in verse 2. It said, let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do, and we sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us up hither. In other words, the Assyrian king brought us people up here. Now these would be the Samaritans. Remember how we talked about the origin of the Samaritans? That when Israel was taken captivity, the wild animals started tearing up the land, and so they brought many of the Assyrians back down. And they mingled with the old and decrepit Jews, and through the crossbreeding, you have the Samaritans come into play. So these people right here would be of that Samaritan lineage in there. So they said, let us do this because we believe in your God too. Now look at what Zerubbabel says in verse 3. He said, you have nothing to do with us in the building of the house unto our God, but we ourselves together will build unto Jehovah. And Cyrus told us to, and we're going to do it. In other words, we do not want to be associated with heathens in any way, shape, or form in this work. This is God's work. We're going to do it in God's way. So we'll do it ourselves. Now, when that happened, verse 4, then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purposes. So the Samaritan says, well, if you don't want us to build with you, then we're going to tear up your work. Isn't that what you're supposed to do? If I can't play with your ball, then I'll punch a hole in it. Or I'll do something, see? So we'll just tear it up. We'll tear up the work. So they hired counselors to say, what can we do to frustrate them and do this? So they had a whole lot of plans, and they put it into practice in there, and trying to destroy the work. They couldn't get the work destroyed, so finally down in verse 11, they write a letter to the king. Now this is a copy of the letter that they sent unto Artaxerxes, the king. Now, we're not going to take time to read this, but I'll point out a few things, point out the verses where they said it. What they did is, they said, "Dear King, we love you so very much, and we're writing this in your best interest. And we want you to know that those Jews that have come back over here and started to rebuild the city of Jerusalem are going to do it to your detriment. They are coming back, and these people will rebel against you. Once they get the city built, then they'll rebel. Now, if you don't believe us, you check your own records of history and see what they did all through history. And you will find, down in verse 15, that this city is a rebellious city. So, we just want to let you know that these people have this reputation. They're getting ready to do it again. And since we care for you, we highly suggest you stop their work." So the letter goes back. The king then tells his historians. He says, go find out if that's true. Well, when they checked the history books, what did they find out about old Jerusalem? Oh, cantankerous, rebellious. Remember how that they'd constantly rebel in that way? Yeah. So he said, well, I'll say. There it is. So in verse 21, he writes back, actually in verse 17, but in verse 21, here's the king's orders. Now, this is not Cyrus. Remember who let him go? Cyrus. A new king has come in now. So a new king, Artaxerxes, has come in. And so he says, "Make you now a decree to cause these men to cease, that this city be not builded until a decree be made by me." So stop the work. Stop it right now. See? So in chapter 4, we find that you have a stop workage order in there. No more building. They don't stop work. Take whatever is necessary, because that city is not to be built. So they took the king's letter. They ran up there like a bunch of little kids. "We told you so, and we're going to stop this thing." So down in verse 23, the latter part, they went in haste to Jerusalem unto the Jews and made them to cease by force and power. Said, "You will cease. We have the authority to declare war on you. And if you do not stop the building of that building, there's going to be war. We're going to do this." So they stopped it. 24, "Then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, and it ceased until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia." So they stopped the work. Now, the very thing that they've come back to do has been frustrated. It's been stopped. The next king put forth an order and said, "You cannot build that building." But now, does the building have to be built? Yeah, we've got to restore Old Testament religion. Why? To keep the line going for what purpose?
Christ.
The Christ. That's right. He gave the promise to Abraham through thy seed, and thy seed will be here, and God is going to see nothing happens. The building has to be built. But if they try to build the building now, there's going to be war breakout. All right. Chapter 5. Grab a hold of your seats now. Now the prophets, Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem, in the name of the God of Israel, prophesied they unto them. Guess what prophets we're going to study next? Right here, see? There we know now which are going to be your prophets in the restoration. So your restoration prophets then is going to be Haggai and Zechariah. They come on the scene. Now remember a couple of weeks ago when I told you, when I said, every time I've asked you, what did a prophet say? What was his message? It was doom. I said, don't ever say that again. Remember that? Now we're down to this point. What do you think the prophet's message is going to be now? Without ever reading it, without knowing anything about it, what could you guess the message is going to be about?
Restore the temple.
That's right. Get busy and build. That's what it's going to be about. See? God is our God. We can do it if God is on our side. Don't stop. Don't give up. Be faithful. Build, build. Go, go, go. It will be successful. Success. It will be done. Just exactly the opposite, you see, of what it was before. Before it was, unless you repent, it's doom. It won't do any good to go to war. You're going to be taken into captivity. Don't fight. Give up. Prepare to meet your God. Doom. You've had it. See? Trying to get them to repent. Now the message is going to be just exactly the opposite. But when we put the prophets in their proper historical setting, then we can see that really is what it's all about. So in verse 2, then rose up Zerubbabel. He's the guy in charge of the building, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua the son of so-and-so, and began to build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, and with them were the prophets of God helping them. So now we have these two prophets that are prophesying and saying, go do it, go build it, and so forth in this. Now as they prophesied and saying, go for it and go build it and so forth, it says right here, at the same time then the governor and so forth wrote, and he said, who gave you a decree to build this house and to finish this wall? Now, at this time, King Artaxerxes has said no more building. But all of a sudden they start building. And wouldn't people go up and ask, where did you get authority to build? The king says, don't build. Where did you get the authority to build? See? Well, why did they start building? Because of the prophets. See, God sent the prophets and to go in and encourage them and do it and so forth. Now, try to put yourself back in the shoes of these people. A lot of times, you know, I get to thinking, boy, I wish I'd lived back there with those prophets back in the easy days. Wouldn't it be nice to live back there? You'd have really got in there and you'd have fought. There wouldn't have been any question about it. You know, I mean, you know where I would have been. Boy, I'd been right out there. Now, let's be realistic about it. What happens when Haggai and Zechariah comes along and says, get to building that thing. Don't pay any attention to anybody. Everybody go to work. Now, what's the setting?
Where's our decree?
Now, where's old Lowell? I'm going to say, hey, guy, what makes you think we can do that? I mean, these guys have authority from the king, if we build, for them to come in and declare war. And they're stronger than we are. And if I go out and start rebuilding that thing without lawful authority, I'm going to get killed. And now I can see old Lowell crawling back, see? And I can see him say, boy, I wish I was born in the 1900s down there where things were easier, see? So these people, when they went out and started building again, they went out at the risk of their life, see? They know that they are going to provoke war. Now, if the people around about can't whip them, who can? Artaxerxes. They have disobeyed his commandment. And he now is ruling the world. You suppose the world ruler could come down, get all of his army together and take care of them because they disobeyed? Now what would you do if the prophet comes along and says, go do it, no problem, God's on our side. Yeah, but the whole world is against us. See? I mean the whole world. The guy that has the army to conquer the entire world, he has a stop work order on here and said, do it by force. Oh, don't worry about that. God's on our side. Would you have the faith? There's the point I want us to see. See, this is real life history, real life things. And these people had to have a lot of courage to go out and do this. All right. So they said, who did this? So they said, they told him, he said, Cyrus told us that we could do this. And we have the authority and we are going to do this very thing. So they go back and they write a letter back to the King Artaxerxes. And they say, these fellows say that they have authority from your predecessor, Cyrus, that he gave authority. So they send a letter back and they said, would you check the records? And so they sent it back and he said, go down and check the records. They went down and checked the records. And what do you suppose they found? Yeah, there's law from Cyrus. Why didn't Artaxerxes just override it and say, well, cancel that? What was there about the laws of the Medes and the Persians?
You couldn't revoke them.
Once it's given, it cannot be revoked, even by the king himself. Why was it that the king couldn't relieve Daniel after he found out he'd been tricked?
Because he had already given the order.
He had signed it under false pretense there of these people, but once he signed it, it cannot be revoked. So the king goes down, finds, sure enough, he did it. So he sends back a letter and says, it's in the books. Now then, not only are you to remove the stop order, but you're to help them and give them all the help that they need. If they need physical supplies, supply it. That city is to be built. And if anybody tries to stop it, look down in verse 7, chapter 6 and verse 7. Let the work of this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God in its place. And said, if anybody tries to stop him, go and yank a beam out of his house and hang him on the beam. I mean, that's pretty tough speaking. Kill anybody that tries to stop. So let the building of this house go forward. So it did go forward. And then in chapter 6, look down in verse 14, who are the two prophets? And the elders of the Jews built it and prospered through the prophesying of Haggai and Zechariah. And they built it and finished it according to the commandment of God of Israel and according to the decree of Cyrus. So they finished and they built that temple. See, just exactly the way God said that they were going to do it. All right, now here is an interesting point. As our historians have checked on this, they've checked on the dates. They started at a certain year and a certain king, and then they ended in a certain year of another king and so forth. Right here you see it says it was the sixth year of the king of Darius and so forth. All right, what really happened, as you can see, is that over here in Haggai chapter 1 verse 5, why would I go to Haggai, by the way? All of a sudden,
he's one of the prophets.
He's one of the prophets. Now, when he wrote his book, Haggai, chapter 1, verse 15, he gives the exact date when they started the work again. See, when they got the resume. So they started it again in there. And then, over here in Ezra, chapter 6, and verse 15, that's when they completed it. They completed the work then there. Now, there was 21 years interval that's in there that it took them to go ahead and do this. We're told by one fellow that figured it up, and I just took it out of the commentary today, I didn't check on it, that once God sent Haggai and Zechariah, once that happened, and they got started there, it was 4 years, 5 months, and 10 days, and the building was up then when they got it going in there. But at any rate, what we see then is, down to this point, who is our leader? Zerubbabel. Who are the two prophets?
Haggai and Zechariah.
What is the one purpose?
Rebuild the temple.
Rebuilding the temple. See, rebuilding the house. By the way, we're studying the book of Ezra. Where's he? We haven't even mentioned him, have we? We're halfway through the book and haven't even mentioned Ezra. Alright, we go on down now, and in verse 19, and the children of the captivity kept the Passover until the 14th day of the first month, and skip on down to verse 22, they kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy, for Jehovah had made them joyful, and they turned the heart of the king of Assyria unto them to strengthen their hand to the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. So everything went along fine. Now the king of Assyria is turned, and he is helping them to do this great work. All right. With the end of chapter 6, you come to the first section of the book of Ezra. Right there. That's the first section. Ezra's not mentioned. Now the reason he's not mentioned is because he's not back there yet. He's still back over in Babylonian captivity. And this tells the first group of people that came out to rebuild the temple. Wonder why I keep going over that. I'm leading you up to something, obviously. They came back, Zerubbabel came back to rebuild the temple, and it tells about the job that they did, and they got the temple rebuilt. Now, here is an interesting thing. As you start chapter 7, you find that the rest of the chapter, the rest of the book now, is going to be dealing with Ezra's work. This is where he's going to come into play, be dealing with his work, and there is a period of 56 years between chapter 6 and 7. Okay? 56 years. Zerubbabel was the leader in chapters 1 through 6. Ezra now is going to take over in chapters 7 through 10. And in between there, this period of time in here, there was a period of 56 years. Now you say, how do you know there were 56 years? Well, if you go up to chapter 6 and verse 15, and you look there, it's the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. Now, if you skip on over to chapter 7 and down in verse 7, there is the seventh year of Artaxerxes. You go back and study the secular history, and there's 56 years between that. That's how you know is in the secular history. So, as we start out now in chapter 7, this will be 56 years later. Now, what's been built so far? The temple. How much good and bad can happen in a nation in 56 years? All right, now what I want you to see is what we're getting ready to deal with. It may blow your mind here in a minute. And you say, how could they do that so quickly? Well, it wasn't quickly. It's several years happening now in between this. So now as we pick up our story in chapter 7, we now are going to be introduced to Ezra. Ezra now is getting ready to come back. So look in chapter 7 and down in verse 6. Here it says, this Ezra, now this is the guy, went up from Babylon, and he was a ready scribe in the law of Moses, which Jehovah the God of Israel had given, and the king granted him all his requests according to the hand of Jehovah his God upon him. So Ezra now is a scribe. That is, he is a learned man. He's an educated man. He can read and write and so forth. And so he's coming back, and now then his job is to restore the law. What was Zerubbabel doing?
Restoring the temple.
Restoring the temple. Now we're getting ready to see different guys are going to do different jobs. Ezra now is coming back where the temple has already been restored, and it's his job to restore the law. He's going to study the law and start preaching to the people and teaching the people, here is what God would have us to have. Now, look down in verse 10. In verse 10, there is a very commendable and potent statement about Ezra. It says, Ezra had set his heart. Now that means he made a determination. He did something. He determined what he was getting ready to do. All right, what was he going to do? Three things. Is he going to rebuild the temple? No, doesn't have anything to do with it. Going to restore the walls around the city? No, not Ezra. Here's what Ezra's going to do. He's going to seek the law of Jehovah, number one. And when he finds what God would have him to do, what feast days to keep, what ordinances that God would have them to do, then he is going to do it. And then he's going to teach in Israel statutes and ordinances. So he's going to find what God says in the law, he's going to be obedient to God, and he's going to teach the Jews to be obedient. Now, why is this such a strange thing? Why haven't they been doing this all along? Where have they been for the last 70 years?
Captivity.
They've been in captivity. That's right. And so they haven't had access to that ready law and so forth. And so they come out and they now are going to be ignorant of it. So now we have then the individual that is getting ready to restore the law. All right, the rest of the book is pretty simple now. And so we can rush through it pretty quickly here. It's a rather interesting thing how this man, verse 11, Artaxerxes, he writes Ezra a letter for it carried with him, giving his authority to do all of this. And he tells the people, this fella is coming back, and I'm giving you a decree. I'm making a law of how you're to treat him. Look down at verse 21. Well, in 18. And whatsoever shall seem good to thee and to thy brethren to do with the rest of the silver and gold, that do ye after the will of God. Now, I'm giving you authority to do anything that you desire to do. Now, what is it he desires to do? He's coming back to do the law. So whatever it is that you're supposed to do. Look in verse 23. Whatsoever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be done exactly for the house of the God of heaven. For why should there be wrath against the realm of the king, his son? In other words, I don't want Jehovah God to be mad at me. See? So you, I'm talking now as hard as Xerxes, you people do whatever you need to do and don't let anybody hold you back. So he now has the authority to restore the law, just like Zerubbabel had the authority to rebuild that temple. Now we move into chapter 8. Skip down to verse 16. See if you see a name down there that you recognize. There it is, isn't it? There's your prophet. He's still there prophesying, you see. Now, in chapter 8, it tells about Ezra's trip back. Ezra is leaving Babylon, and he's coming back. Now, this again shows you human feelings. See, human feelings. They had their fears just like we have our fears. See if you can relate to this. Down in verse 21, he's headed back, and he said, I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Hava, that we might humble ourselves before God to seek of Him a straight way for us and for our little ones and for all the substance. For I was ashamed to ask of the king a band of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy in the way, because we had spoken unto the king, saying, the hand of our God is upon all them that seek Him for good, but His power and His wrath is against all them that forsake Him. So we fasted and besought our God for this, and He was entreated of us. Now, if you ever have any embarrassing moments of your failures, of where you say, I have said some things, and I'm not sure that I, you know, can live up to them, and I don't know really what to do, and so forth, here's a case. Ezra had gone in and told the king, King, you turn us loose, and people that fear God and the hand of God, God protects them. And those that are opposed to God, God will destroy them. So he says, okay, go. So Ezra takes all of this wealth, everything that he's got, and heads out. Will any enemies try to take it away from him? Now, what he would like to have would be part of the Babylonian army to come along with him, see, to protect him. But he said, I was embarrassed to go back and ask the king. Because I had told the king, our God protects those of us that care for him. Sure wish I had some soldiers. But I'm not going to go back because that would be embarrassing to go back. So what does he do? Bows down and cast his cares upon God. Now the next time that you get yourself in a problem and trouble, and you're going to, like tonight or tomorrow, the next time we get ourselves in a problem and we say, I don't know what to do. I just don't know what to do. Anyway, I turn and so forth and all that. Remember what Peter's, cast your cares upon him. Now when you cast your cares upon him, do you have to know how God's going to work it out? No, you don't have to know how God's going to work it out. You see, just cast your cares upon him and go ahead and do what God would have you to do. See, and if you feel, well, I don't know whether I did a good job, I maybe shouldn't have opened my mouth and so forth. Yeah, that's part of human failure, but cast your cares upon him. And so that's what he did here. All right. Now we go into chapter 9. Now, in chapters 9, here we find that certain things happen. In chapters 9 and 10, we go back and find that the Jews are engaged in horrible, horrible sin again. Now, I said we might be a little shocked. How could they get in sin so quickly? How many years have they been over there? It's been 56 years between the building of the temple and the time Ezra came, and then it was some years before that, so it's been about close to 80 years at this time that they have been over there. Now, in this 80-year period of time, they've been struggling with what few laws that they have, and they, to be frankly, to put it in everyday common, ordinary English, they've blown it again. See, just like they did back at the very beginning. So it comes over and it says this, at verse 9. Now when these things were done, the princes, that is the rulers, drew near unto me, saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the land, doing according to their abominations, even of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites and the Ammonites and the Moabites. Does that ring a bell? Yeah. All right. Now, you go back up here, and I've given these scriptures here. When you get back up there, all of those scriptures, God warned his people way back in the days of Moses, hundreds of years before they went into captivity. As soon as they went into the land of Canaan, he said, don't you have any commerce with these people. And by commerce, I mean no relationship, no association. You drive them out. How many could they keep as a slave? Don't you even keep a person in there as a slave, not even as a woodcutter. Because if you keep a woodcutter, that evil person will pollute somebody, they'll pollute someone, and the nation will be polluted and go into sin. Don't you marry any of them. Not a single one are you to marry. But what did the Jews do when they went into Canaan the first time? They kept a few woodcutters, they kept some slaves, and they did intermarry. And then, did it lead them into sin or not? Into sin they went. Now, God has made it plain, don't you do that. That is what the law says. Excuse me. Well, they are once again doing the same thing. It said in verse 2, for they have taken of their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the peoples of the land. The Jews now are married to heathens. Now we have the people of God married to the idolaters, and we're starting this whole thing out over again. So, when Ezra heard that, verse 3, when I heard this thing, I rent my garment, my robes, and plucked off the hair of my head and my beard and sat down confounded. When you come across a Jew without a beard, what do you know? It's kind of like running across a man with his hair just absolutely shaved. You look and you say, What's the problem? In other words, does he have a disease, or has he done this on purpose? You see, it is something that catches your attention. Now, all Jews wore their beards. He cut off all of his beard, sitting there, tore his clothes. He's in repentance. Verse 4, then were assembled unto me everyone that trembled at the words of the God of Israel because of the trespass of them of the captivity, and I sat confounded until the evening oblation. So everybody that trembled at the Word of God, everybody that had that awesome fear and reverence for the Word of God came. And Ezra said, I was confounded. I didn't know what to do. And I just sat there. And I thought until the evening oblation, which would be 3:00 in the afternoon. At the evening oblation, I arose. When they got ready to go out and offer the evening blood offerings, then for the people, he said, I arose, went in with my garment and my robe rent. I fell upon my knees, and I spread my hands unto God, and I prayed. Now here's the prayer that he offered to God. He said, O my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift my face to thee. I don't even want to look up, which was a common position of prayer. I just blush to raise my face to look at you. He said, for our iniquities are increased over our head, and our guiltiness is grown into the heavens. Since the days of our fathers, we have been exceeding guilty unto this day. And for our iniquities have we, our kings and priests, been delivered into the hands of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, to plunder, and to confusion of face, as it is this day. Does Ezra know why they went into captivity? Yeah, because of our sins. Now, right here tells how they felt while they were in captivity. How'd they feel? It says in here that under the hand of the king, the land of the lands, to the sword and to captivity and to plunder and to confusion of face. What does that mean? Totally mixed up. We are in there walking without law, walking without your guidance. You remember what the message of Ezekiel was? Now, we know they went in because of sin. You remember that trick question I asked you? Did they go in because of sin? Either way you answer it, you're wrong. They didn't go in because of sin. What did they go in for? Because God had left them. See, that's it. Now, why had God left them? Sin. So you see what I mean. I mean, the answer is that way. But they've gone in, they were sinful, and God then, from Ezekiel's viewpoint, says, the reason you're going is God is leaving you people. And you're going to have confusion of face, not knowing what to do. And now for a little moment, he said, grace has been shown from Jehovah our God to leave us a remnant to escape and to give us a nail in the holy place. How does he describe the Jewish people now? Here it is. We've gone into captivity in here, taken us into captivity, and now we've come out here, but for a moment. We're out now for just a little while. And how many came out? What did he call them? The remnant. All right, the remnant of Israel here is coming out. Wonder what it means when you have given us a nail. We've got an expression that I don't even have a nail to hang my hat on. What does that mean? Possession. See? Very poor. Don't have much, all right? Now, you've given us just these things that we've got right now, but what have we done in verse 9? For we are bondmen, yet our God hath not forsaken us in our bondage, but hath extended loving kindness to us in the sight of the kings of Persia, to give us reviving, to set up the house of our God, and to repair the ruins thereof, and to give us a wall in Judah and in Jerusalem. By the way, have we mentioned that wall before? Have we got the wall built yet? No, wall isn't built yet. But it's in the building. See, it's in there somewhere. We'll get to it a little bit later. Who rebuilt the temple? Who restored the law?
Ezra.
Next week we'll talk about the walls. All right. He says, "And now, God, what shall we say after this?" So then he confesses the sins. He said in verse 12, "Now therefore give not your sons to their daughters." You've told us that. Don't you give your sons to your daughters or take their daughters unto your sons, nor seek their peace or their prosperity forever. You told us not to do that. But Lord, we've turned right around and we've disobeyed you and we've done that very thing. And so, in verse 15, he said, "O Jehovah, the God of Israel, thou art righteous, for we are left a remnant that is escaped as it is in this day. Behold, we are before thee in our guiltiness, for none can stand before thee because of this." We've gone right back into the same sin that we were in before, and we'll not be able to stand. It has to be corrected. So, in chapter 10, he now starts his corrective procedures. In verse 2, he calls the people to gather. In verse 10:1, it said, "He prayed and made confession and weeping." He is hurt. He's hurt because of the sins they're involved in. In verse 2, "We have transgressed against our God," he tells the people, "and have married foreign women of the peoples of the land. Yet now there is hope for Israel concerning this thing. Even though we've turned around and sinned again and done the same thing over again." Have you ever done that? Have you ever done anything wrong, said anything? You said, I'll watch my tongue, I'll never say anything again. And then you turn around later and you do it. Why did I do it? See? Have you ever felt like that? If you do it the second time, and especially the third, that God won't forgive you? If that's true, you don't know the God of the Bible. See, you don't know the loving kindness of God. How many times has God forgiven these people of the same stuff? Over and over and over and over. And Ezra says there's still hope. There still is hope. So he said in verse 3, "Now therefore let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and such as are born of them, according to the counsel of my Lord and of those that tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law." Let's do what God says to do according to the law. Verse 10, "And Ezra the priest stood up and said unto them, Ye have trespassed, married foreign women to increase the guilt of Israel. Now therefore make confession unto Jehovah, the God of your fathers, and do His pleasure, and separate yourself from the people of the land and from the foreign women." They do. And if you think that it wasn't heartaches there, look at the last verse of the book of how he chooses to conclude. "And these had taken foreign wives, and some of them had wives by whom they had children." And so they had to break that. Now, as you look at this, one says, a question might arise, well, what about marriages today and so forth along this line? If you're married to a heathen today, what does the New Testament say over on this side of the cross of Christ in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and in verse 12? If a believer is married to an unbeliever, should they leave him? No. Remain with them if they be content to dwell with you. But if the heathen says, "You're either going to go with my heathen practices or I'm leaving," what do you say? Let him leave. See, let him leave. You're not under bondage in such cases. So this right here, as we need to understand, them taking foreign women was in direct violation to a direct commandment of God. Do not marry women from that nation. They went over and married women from that nation. They had no authority from God to do that. They had to break it. Now, it would be the same thing today. God has said, you are not to marry someone of the same sex. What would you do if two homosexuals came and said, we're married, we want to serve God? What would you say? No, you don't serve God under those circumstances. God says a man can't marry a man. See, a woman can't marry a woman. And so that marriage is not right before God. And so it is just that clear. He said, don't you marry that Canaanite. They married the Canaanite, and now then break it up. So in order to restore that law, so that the people were obedient to God the way that they were supposed to be, there were great pains that had to take place. So now then, as we go back to restore the Old Testament religion, we now have the temple restored, we have the law restored, and we have two prophets that are prophesying. What are their names?
Haggai and Zechariah.
Okay. Come back next week. No, don't come back next week to see what we're going to talk about. We'll not have class next week. For those of you who came in late, our gospel meeting will begin on Thursday night, and so we'll not have a Wednesday night class next week. We'll have a Wednesday morning and have all the other classes during the week, but not the Wednesday night. Yes, Dave?
You talked before that the Jews went in there that they would put away their idolatry. In the 70 years they were in there and 56 years after and everything, now there's no mention of idolatry, but everything else. Is there anything that tells us, other than the Lord said there wouldn't be any, why they didn't adhere to the idols that were over them in captivity and when they were out?
No, there's nowhere where it tells us. You have to infer it from what God says. What God said is, I'm going to leave you alone for 70 years with your gods. That's who you've been wanting to serve. So here it is, Dave. Take your gods, goodbye, for 70 years. Well, during that 70 years, you're going to see what your gods do for you. And you're going to give them up. And then God makes his approach again and says, now come out and follow me. And so they came out without idols. Mm-hmm. Okay, class dismissed.